It was two more weeks before the trial was held, which was the time it took for Circuit Judge Anion Heckmeyer to come to Kuhara to hold court. With the jury impaneled, the trial began. After his opening statement, Doug Jeter, the prosecutor, called his first witness. Dan Dunnigan testified that he had heard gunfire, then saw three masked men run from the bank, mount horses that were being held by a fourth man, unmasked, then gallop out of town. He further testified that he then ran into the bank where he saw Mrs. Foley sitting against the front of the teller's cage, bleeding from a wound to her chest.
Did she say anything?
Yes, sir. She said it was Boone Parker and Al Hennessy what done it.
Thank you. Your witness, Counselor.
Young Counselor Gilmore stood up and approached the bench.
You said the three men who ran from the bank were wearing masks, did you not?
Yes, sir, they was.
Did you recognize any of them?
No, sir.
So then, you can't be certain that any of my clients are the ones you saw.
Oh, yes, sir. They was the ones.
How can you be certain of that?
There's more ways to recognize a person than just their faces.
Oh. And pray tell us, Mr. Dunnigan, what those ways are.
Well, sir, one of them was tall, with big floppy ears and a nose that you could tell was big even behind the kerchief he was wearing, like that first feller there.
Let the record show that Mr. Dunnigan has pointed out Boone Parker.
Another had a scar come down over his left eye, like that second fella there.
Let the record show that Mr. Dunnigan has identified Al Hennessy.
Then there was the short, bandy-legged fella there.
That would be Edward Coleman.
And then there was one that was getting on his horse, holding the other three. He didn't have no mask on first time I seen him.
Let the record show that Mr. Dunnigan has identified Billy Taylor.
But it could be anyone with big ears, bandy legs, or tall and thin. Not necessarily these men. Because the truth is, you didn't see their faces.
Oh, it was these ones.
You did not see their faces, did you?
No, sir. I didn't see them three men's faces, but I seen his.
No further questions, Your Honor.
The prosecutor brought three more witnesses who testified that they heard Mrs. Foley identify her killers before she died. Then Matt Jensen was brought to the stand. He testified as to the conversation he heard through the door of the cabin when he found the men.
Objection, Your Honor. That's hearsay evidence.
Your Honor, Mr. Jensen is reporting what he heard directly from the mouths of the defendants, not what someone told him they heard. That makes his testimony directly relevant, not hearsay.
Objection overruled.
When Jeter was finished with his examination, Gilmore stood for the cross-examination.
Mr. Jensen, were you involved in a shooting incident last week?
Yes, I was involved in a shooting last week.
Tuesday night, I believe?
It was Tuesday.
Who did you kill?
Man's name was Rufus Clay.
Did you know Mr. Clay?
Your Honor, I object. Where is Counselor going with this?
I will show relevancy, Your Honor.
Please do.
Did you know Mr. Clay?
No, I never seen him before that night.
Did you know that when Mr. Clay came to town that day, he was with Boone Parker?
I've been told that.
Is it not possible, Mr. Jensen, that your testimony against Mr. Parker might be self-serving?
Self-serving? In what way?
You did kill Rufus Clay, did you not? And he was with Boone Parker. I suggest, Mr. Jensen, that you might have some personal animus against Boone Parker because he was with Rufus Clay on the night Clay tried to kill you. Is it not possible that you fear some possible future retaliation from Parker as a result of you having killed his friend? So you have taken it upon yourself to blame him for the bank robbery and murder just to get him out of the way?
Your Honor, I object. There is not one bit of evidence to support this ridiculous suggestion, and my esteemed colleague knows it.
I withdraw the comment, and I have no further questions.
Gilmore was smiling as he returned to the defendant's table.
What are you smiling about? You withdrew the statement.
I withdrew my statement, but you can't unring a bell. I made my point before the jury.
Following Matt's testimony, the banker Matthews testified that the amount of money in the sack Matt brought back with him was exactly equal to the amount of money that had been taken on the morning of the robbery. After that, the state rested its case.
The state's entire case is built upon hearsay evidence. Prosecution could not produce one eyewitness. Oh, they had witnesses who said they heard Mrs. Foley identify Boone Parker and Hal Hennessy. But how much weight can we actually give their testimony? There is a reason for not accepting hearsay evidence, and that is because you cannot cross-examine them to check on their story. Now think about it. The robbers were masked. She was an old, frightened woman. She may have just thought she recognized them, and without her here to question, we'll never know, will we? Mr. Jensen testified as to what he heard when he was standing outside the door of the cabin, but at best, that is self-serving testimony. After all, he may have his own reasons for wanting Boone Parker out of the way.
Counselor, you withdrew that statement. I'll not allow it to be revisited.
I beg your pardon, Your Honor. You are quite right. Forget that comment. But, gentlemen of the jury, even forgetting the suggestion that Jensen might have had his own reasons for wanting Boone Parker to go away, and considering that there were no eyewitnesses to the bank robbery and murder, we have only hearsay as to the guilt of my clients. That, my friends, constitutes doubt. And if there is any doubt, you cannot and must not find these men guilty.
Jeter got up for his closing comments.
I want to compliment my esteemed colleague on mounting a brilliant defense under extremely difficult conditions. It is our constitutional duty to see to it that everyone gets the best defense possible, and I do not believe the accused can say they did not. However, despite Mr. Gilmore's best effort, the evidence is overwhelming and compelling. You heard Mr. Dunnigan give very accurate descriptions of each of the men, doing so in a way that would identify them whether or not you saw their faces. You heard Mr. Jensen tell what he heard through the door before he captured the defendants. You heard Mr. Matthews testify that the money Matt Jensen recovered from the robbers matched exactly the amount of money that was stolen in the robbery. And lastly, there is such a thing as dying testimony. Whether or not Emma Foley is present to be cross-examined, she did make the accusation in front of three witnesses. And the fact that it was dying testimony gives it a great deal of weight. Gentlemen of the jury, there is no doubt here. Boone Parker, Al Hennessy, Ed Coleman, and Billy Taylor are all guilty as charged.
After hearing arguments from both sides, the jury found all four accused guilty, and despite the protestations of the other defendants that it was Boone Parker who killed both Mrs. Foley and Frank Meade, the judge sentenced all four to die, the execution to be carried out that very day. With their legs hobbled by chains, Deputy Goodson was given the responsibility of taking the four prisoners from the court to the holding cell. The prisoners shuffled by the crowd of people who had gathered around the courthouse in order to get a ticket that would allow them to watch the hanging. Although all four had been sentenced to hang, the gallows could only accommodate three at a time. Because it was generally agreed that Boone Parker was the one who actually did the shooting, he was selected to hang alone, after the others. Once outside, Deputy Goodson took him across the courtyard toward a small holding cell. It was quiet in the yard since, as yet, no spectators had been allowed around the gallows. As they passed through the shadow of the gallows, someone was up on the deck oiling the hinges to one of the three trap doors. He pulled the lever and the door swung open.
You think it's funny, do you?
Hey, I was just wondering if you're gonna pee in your pants when they drop you through the trapdoor. Hey, come to think of it, Coleman, that might not be such a bad idea. If you pee in your pants, maybe you'll put out the fires in hell and it'll be cool by the time I get there. What are you laughing at, Deputy?
You?
Well, I'm glad we can be so entertaining to you.
Quit your crying, Coleman. We're all in the same boat here.
That ain't fair. We wouldn't none of us be here if Boone hadn't been so trigger-happy. He's the only one should be hanged.
The four men were put in the holding cell where they waited for no more than 15 minutes. Then Goodson came back to get Hennessy, Coleman, and Taylor.
Wait, what are you taking us out now for? Tain't even nobody out there yet.
The judge wants you boys already up on the gallows before we let anyone in to watch.
Boys, if you get there in time for supper, save a place at the devil's table for me, will you?
As they started across the courtyard, the man who had been working on the gallows came down and started walking towards them. As soon as he was even with them, he pulled a gun and pointed it at the deputy's head.
Cut him loose.
Well, you ain't Jules. Where's Jules? Who are you?
I'm the man that's already killed Jules, and I'm gonna blow your brains out too if you don't do what I tell you to do.
Now unlock those hobbles, like I said.
Howdy, Strayhorn. It's good to see you.
Strayhorn! Strayhorn! Don't forget me! Sorry, Boone, but I got me some ideas of my own, and there ain't room for 2 liters.
You son of a bitch! You can't leave me here!
Yeah, I can.
From behind the courthouse, a rider appeared, leading 4 horses. Strayhorn looked up at him.
Have any trouble, Teach?
Yeah, I had to knife the guard at the back gate. You boys hurry up and get mounted. We gotta get out of here.
Let's go!
For just a moment, the prisoners took their eyes off the deputy. Goodson used that moment to draw his own pistol.
Hold it! You ain't going nowhere!
Strayhorn turned toward the deputy. Goodson fired back, hitting Coleman.
Come on, boys, let's go!
What about Coleman?
What about him?
Coleman lay in a spreading pool of blood on the ground behind him.
Don't leave me, you bastards! Don't leave me here like this!
By now, the shouts and gunfire had alerted the others, and several armed men appeared in the courtyard just in time to see the 4 riders gallop through the back gate. The entire band had got away. Later that same day, Boone Parker was led to the gallows. His legs weren't hobbled, but his hands were handcuffed behind his back. He hesitated at the foot of the 13 steps.
Get up there, Parker. These good folks have already missed one hanging. I don't intend to disappoint them again.
Well, Sheriff, maybe you could come on up here and hang alongside me. The folks ought to really like that.
You know, there might be some who would be pleased at that. Come on, Boone. The sooner we get this over with, the better it is for all of us.
Boone moved down to the scaffold and was positioned under the noose. From there, he had a very good look into the faces of the spectators, and he glared at them defiantly.
Any last words, Boone?
Just get it done.
The sheriff nodded, and the hangman stepped up to slip a hood over Boone's head. Once the hood was in place, he fit the noose. Then he stepped over to the handle, then looked at Sheriff Craig. The sheriff nodded. Matt was playing cards in the saloon when the sheriff came in a few minutes later.
Matt, can I talk to you for a few minutes?
Matt looked at his hand and smiled, then laid it down.
Sure. As bad as this hand is, you're probably saving me a couple of dollars by pulling me out of the game. I'm out, boys.
Matt scooped up the money that was in front of him and followed the sheriff back to the corner of the saloon. They stood alongside the silent piano to hold their conversation.
I've got a posse together.
How many men do you have?
10. I started out with over 20, but about half of them backed out.
You'd be better off if about half of what you have left quit as well.
I know you feel that way, but there are at least 4 out there that we know about, and there may be a few more. One of them was Marcus Strayhorn, and he's known to have a few men riding with him.
My offer still stands, Sheriff. If you would like, I'll go after them myself.
I appreciate your offer, but there's no way I can send my posse home. These men want to go, Matt.
I know. I'm not saying you give up your posse. I'm just saying I'll go after them myself independent of your posse, if you'd like.
No, I'd rather you not. What I really want you to do is stay on here and act as my deputy while I'm gone. What with Goodson dead, I don't even have a deputy to look after the peace right now.
All right, I'll do that for you if you like.
Yes, I would very much like. And I thank you for agreeing to take on the job.
Sheriff Craig!
Looking toward the front door, they saw Staley standing there. Staley was wearing a wool-lined sheepskin coat and carrying a Winchester rifle.
I'm back here, Staley.
Staley looked around the room until he spotted Craig. Then, when he saw Matt, he scowled.
I thought you said he wasn't going with us.
He's not going with us. I've just asked him to be my deputy while we're gone.
Good. I don't want to be riding with anyone who don't want to be riding with us.
What is it, Staley? What do you want?
Oh, all the rest of the boys is down to the sheriff's office waiting on you.
Good. We'll get on our way then.
Cairo, Illinois. Lane McKenzie was a strikingly pretty woman with raven black hair, brown eyes, high cheekbones, and lips that were a little fuller than average. After graduation from Southern Illinois University in Carbondale, she returned home to Cairo to apply for a job as a teacher in the Cairo school system. The examination process had been much more difficult than she anticipated, perhaps because there were 4 teachers applying for one position. All four had had to take a test, then be interviewed by the members of the Cairo School Board. After more than a week of waiting, Lane had finally received a letter from the school board asking her to appear before them at 2 p.m. today. Because Cairo sat at the confluence of the Ohio and Mississippi rivers, it was a major hub of river traffic, not only from the north, but from the east. Also, because it was the railroad gateway that connected the south to the north and the west to the east, it was a major rail hub. Lane could see ample evidence of that now, because from the anteroom she had a view of the many boats that were tied up at the bank of the Ohio River. And from the window on the opposite side of the room, she could see the depot where, even now, two of the 65 passenger trains that pass through Cairo daily were standing in the station, taking on or discharging passengers. She waited nervously in the anteroom, wondering what she had forgotten or what questions she had failed to answer properly when the door to the meeting room opened and Mr. Stallings stepped out into the anteroom. Stallings was the secretary of the school board and, or so she had perceived, had been the most difficult questioner during the interview proceedings. She hoped that his summoning her was not a bad sign.
Miss McKenzie, would you please step into the meeting room?
Nodding, Lane picked up her handbag and followed his invitation. Lane knew two of the school board members and had known them for most of her life. One was a banker, the other was the minister at her church. They smiled at her as she entered the room, and that eased her nervousness.
Congratulations, Miss McKenzie. The school board is pleased to offer you employment as a teacher in our system, with a starting salary of $40 per month. You'll start next fall.
The question now,
Lane spoke to her mother and father that evening,
is what do I do from now until school starts next fall? I shall go crazy hanging around doing nothing.
I have an idea. My brother has been wanting you to come west for a visit. Suppose I write to him and see if this is a good time.
Oh, yes. I would love to go. Father, please do write him.
Of course. But you will be on your own for a long time, so please be very careful.
I shall be. Father, I promise.
Boys, we got 'em.
Staley was looking around the area to which they had tracked the men they were chasing.
I've been here before. This here is a dead-end canyon. There ain't no way out of here excepting to come back this way. We got them trapped.
Sheriff Craig stopped at the mouth of the canyon and took a drink from his canteen while he studied the canyon.
Staley's right. This is a dead-end canyon, all right. The question is, do Strayhorn and his men know that it's dead-end? If they know, why would they go into it?
Why would they go into it? Easy, they don't know it's a dead-end.
But what if they do know?
All right, maybe they do know. But maybe they figure we wouldn't count on them going into a dead-end canyon like this.
Or maybe they figure to draw us in so they can set up an ambush for us.
So what if that is their plan? What are we gonna do? Just let them stay in there? I mean, come on. There are only four of them. There are 10 of us. I figure that no matter what they have planned, we can handle it.
Craig hooked his canteen back onto the pommel and pulled his rifle from the saddle holster.
All right, let's play this hand out.
Craig started walking into the canyon leading his horse. The others followed.
Brass band.
What? What's that you say?
I was thinking about something Matt Jensen told me about posses. He said you may as well have a brass band with you.
I don't understand.
You wouldn't.
The canyon made a 45-degree turn to the left just in front of him, so Craig held up his hand as a signal for all to stop.
What are we stopping for?
If they're waiting for us, this is where they'll be.
Hell, there's one good way to find out.
Staley slapped his horse on the rump and sent it on in ahead.
Yeah, there's nobody there. If there was, they'd have shot at my horse. If you want to know what I think they're all up at the far end, trying to climb out. Like I said, we got them trapped. Come on, let's go!
Without waiting for Sheriff Craig, Staley moved around the bend in the canyon.
Staley's hit!
Keep me covered, I'm going after him.
Keep you covered? Keep you covered how?
Move up to the edge here and start shooting.
The rest of the posse moved up to the edge of the canyon and started shooting up toward the canyon walls. Sheriff Craig moved toward Staley. He saw Staley moving.
How bad are you hit?
In my leg!
Turn over on your belly and try to crawl toward me.
Staley did so and started wriggling forward on his belly. Finally, he got close enough to Craig that Craig was able to reach out and pull him behind the relative safety of a large outcropping of rocks. As the shooting continued, Craig and Staley, able to stand now because of the rocks, moved back to join the others. Staley supported on his wounded leg by Craig.
Bartlett's been hit!
How bad?
He dead!
Anyone else hit?
No, but we're gonna get killed if we stay here any longer. I say we get out of here!
No need to do that. Like Staley said, we have them trapped in there. All we have to do is wait them out.
Wait them out? How are we gonna do that? We got, what, 2 more days of food and water?
What do you think they have?
Well, who knows what they have? They could have a month's supply of food and water hidden up there for all we know. I mean, why else would they come into a canyon they know's a dead end? I think they's just setting us up for a trap.
Funny, I thought we were the law.
You might be the law, but we ain't. We just a bunch of clerks and workers, that's all. Would have been good if we could have got them, but there's no way we gonna do that now. And Staley has to get back to a doctor.
Yeah. All right, get mounted. We'll go back.
I ain't got nothing to ride. My horse didn't come back.
Ride Bartlett's horse. He won't need it.
What about Bartlett? We just gonna leave him here?
We'll tie him on behind Staley.
When the posse rode out of Kahara a week earlier, they had been confident and determined, cheered on by the people of the town. But when the posse returned, they were defeated and dispirited, showing the effects of exhaustion, cold weather, and even hunger. Several of the citizens of the town saw the blood on Staley's leg. Others, knowing the makeup of the posse as it left, now put together the fact that the man thrown over the horse behind Staley was Bartlett, and that he was probably dead. The posse broke up the moment they came into town, and most went individually to their homes. Staley went straight to the doctor's office, while Craig took Bartlett's body to the undertaker. After making arrangements for him, Craig rode on down to the sheriff's office. Matt was holding a cup of hot coffee, and he handed it to Craig the moment the sheriff came into the office.
Well, thanks. They got Bartlett. I'm going to have to ride out to his ranch and tell his widow.
I don't envy you that.
I should have listened to you. It was just like you said. We couldn't have announced our presence anymore if we had hired criers to go in front of us. They were waiting for us when we got to Wahite Canyon. They killed Bartlett and they shot Staley.
And the outlaws? What happened to them?
Who knows? They could be in Mexico by now for all I know. My posse lost its enthusiasm.
When you're tracking someone like that, the element of surprise is always your strongest ally. But surprise is damn near impossible with a posse.
Any trouble while we were gone?
Nothing.
Well, thank God for that, at least. After a week like I've just been through, I would hate to come home to something new. I appreciate your sitting in for me while I was gone.
I didn't mind it.
Matt took the badge from his shirt and laid it on the desk in front of Sheriff Craig.
You know, Matt, that badge is yours for as long as you want it.
I appreciate that, I really do. But I think I'll be moving on.
Moving on to where?
I don't know. Maybe Denver?
Denver? What's in Denver?
Apple pie.
I beg your pardon?
There's a place in Denver called Vi's Pies. The lady who owns it, Vivian McKay, makes the best apple pie in the world. I'm gonna go have a piece.
Well, by damn, what a life you lead, Matt, that you can just pull up stakes and go 100 miles away for no reason other than to have a piece of pie. Damn, if I weren't married and didn't have this job, I'd go with you.
Hennessy watched the posse ride away.
Son of a bitch! Son of a bitch! He was right!
So, you changed your mind, have you? Coming into a dead-end canyon wasn't the dumbest thing you ever heard of.
I never would have thought it. I mean, I figured for sure we'd be trapped in here, but they come in like sitting ducks, just like you said they would.
Strayhorn is a smart man. You're better off with him than you were with Boone Parker.
Yeah, I got to admit, I don't think old Boone would have thought anything like this. Of course, it don't matter none nohow, seeing as old Boone is pushing up daisies.
Let's go. I want to be out of here before they decide to come back.
Where are we going?
Dorena.
Who's Dorena?
Dorena ain't who. Dorena is a town. A very special town.
What's so special about it?
You'll see.
Dorena was a very small town. The small adobe buildings that housed the mostly Mexican residents were either in total darkness or barely illuminated by burning embers of mesquite wood or fat-soaked rags. because few could afford candles, and fewer still kerosene lanterns. The outlaws passed a sign that announced the town.
You are entering Dorena. We got our own law. We don't need none of yours.
The town had only one street with a few leaning shacks constructed from rough-hewn lumber, the unpainted wood turning gray and splitting. There was no railroad serving the town, and no signs of the outside world greeted them. It was a self-contained little community, inbred and festering. Strayhorn had been here many times before, and so had Teach, but this was the first time for Hennessy and Taylor.
Man, you say this town has got no law?
No, it's got a law, all right.
It's got a law? Then what the hell are we doing here? What have they got word on our jailbreak?
It ain't that kind of law.
Then I don't understand. What kind of law are you talking about?
It's a law we make amongst ourselves.
Strayhorn headed his horse toward a building that sported a big red sign that said simply, Saloon.
Huh. I don't think I ever seen a saloon that didn't have no name.
This one has a name. It's called Saloon. What more do you need?
How long are we going to be here?
As long as I say we are. Unless you have a hankering to ride out on your own.
No, you're the one who came to save my ass. I reckon I see what you have in mind.
What I have in mind is $25,000.
What?
I thought that might get your attention. I didn't rescue you just because I'm a good guy. I rescued you because I need you and the others to help me pull this off.
And what is it? A bank?
No, it's better than a bank. It's like two banks in one. Next week, the Midnight Flyer of the Denver and Rio Grande is going to be carrying $25,000 to be deposited in two different banks. But the only transfer is to be in our pockets. So, to answer your question, Hennessy, as to how long we are going to stay here, we are going to stay here until that transfer is made.
And you say that'll be sometime next week?
Unless you have some other idea.
No, your idea's fine with me.
Good. I thought you might see it my way.
My only question is, what are we supposed to do until next week? Neither me nor Taylor got a penny to our name.
Oh, that's your problem. That ain't mine. I didn't take you to raise. I got you out of jail. The rest is up to you. All I'm asking is for you to meet me here in the saloon next Tuesday.
Where will we stay till then? What will we eat?
See Boomer.
Who's Boomer?
Boomer owns the saloon. He's nearly always got some job to do. And if he likes you, he'll lend you some money until you do the job. At least enough to eat on.
There were no hotels in Dorena, but there were plenty of whores. Strayhorn had taken full advantage of that fact and was just stepping out of a soiled dove's house.
Yeah. I do love tacos.
Senor!
What? Who is it? Who's there?
A young girl named Maria stepped out from the shadow of the outhouse into the silver splash of moonlight.
Who are you?
Then, when he examined her more closely, he recognized her.
Wait a minute. You're the whore's daughter, ain't you? I seen you in there.
Si, senor. I am Maria.
Well, what do you want, Maria?
I want $1.
A dollar? Now, why would I want to give you a dollar?
Because I will give myself to you for $1.
Quickly, she pulled her dress up over her head, then off, holding the bunched-up cloth in her right hand. She stood before him, totally nude, her young body barely mature, with small breasts and a silky fuzz of emerging pubic hair. Her skin quickly filled with goose flesh, brought on by the chill of the night air.
Damn!
You do want this, don't you? I have seen how you look at me when you visit Mama.
Well, now, you're getting started a little early, ain't you, girlie? Yeah, all right. You want to learn what it's all about, I'll show you.
$1?
A dollar? Girlie, I didn't give your Mama but a quarter. I ain't never had me a whore as young as you, so, you just might be worth it.
Maria waited until Strayhorn stuck his hand into his pocket. Then, dropping the bunched-up dress, she lunged at him with the butcher knife.
What the hell?
Then he reached out to grab her knife hand, causing Maria to lose her only advantage, the element of surprise. Strayhorn easily took the knife from her hand, then he pushed her up against the outhouse.
You see what you did? I was gonna give you a dollar. Now I'm gonna get it for nothing.
Ha ha ha! When Hennessy and Taylor showed up at the saloon the next Thursday to meet with Strayhorn and Teach, they saw four more men with them. The four were Loomis, Cale, Malone, and Mills. Hennessy had met them since coming to Dorena, but he didn't know any of them from before.
Well, I see you boys managed to survive.
Nah, we picked up a few dollars.
Yeah, I heard about your great stagecoach robbery. How much you get?
Enough.
You got $153, and you had to give half of that to Boomer.
What difference does it make to you what we got? It was enough to keep us going till today. So now, where is this $25,000 you say we're going to get?
Like I told you, it's on the midnight flyer. Now get your horses saddled and meet out front in 15 minutes. We got a long way to ride.
It was growing dark as Matt Jensen stepped out onto the platform of the Kahara Depot. He had bought his ticket and made arrangements for Spirit to be loaded onto the stock car that was part of the train. He was now waiting for the train that would take him to Denver. Matt could see the almost luminescent white steam billowing from the drive cylinders. Lane McKenzie had been on trains for nearly 3 days and two nights now, having boarded in Cairo, Illinois. She had but one more night on this train before reaching Denver. It had been an exciting adventure, but as her only sleep had been what she could grab by trying to get comfortable in uncomfortable seats, she was very tired. As the train began slowing for another stop, she shifted positions and looked through the window at the little town. The sign attached to the end of the station house read Kahara, and she rolled the name over on her tongue. The further west she got, the more melodic and exotic sounding were the names of the towns. One of the men standing on the platform caught her attention. He was tall and blonde, and even from the train she could tell that his flashing blue eyes were deep and unexpectedly expressive. The Denver and Rio Grande train number 83, known as the Midnight Flyer, and consisting of an engine, tender, two express cars, and six passenger cars, was on the midnight run working its way up toward Thunder Pass. Scheduled to arrive in Denver at just after sunrise, it was a marvel of 19th century progress in which a person could be whisked some 150 miles in one night. One of the 133 passengers making the trip was Matt Jensen. Matt was sitting alone halfway down the left-hand side of the second of four passenger cars. There was a wood-burning stove at the rear of the car, but the small bubble of heat it put out did very little to push back the numbing cold that permeated the car. As night fell, a porter came through handing out blankets to all the passengers, but Matt gave this to the woman who was traveling with two children, a boy about nine and a girl of six. He then turned the collar up on his wool-lined sheepskin coat and looked through the window at the dark mass of coniferous trees that climbed the sides of the mountains nearby. Although night had fallen, the illuminated cars were projecting little squares of golden light that slid alongside the track with the train, creating a sparkling effect with the fallen precipitation of sleet mixed with snow. Matt saw a wolf dart from some shrub covering, keep pace with the train for about 100 yards, then dart back into the woods. The gentle rocking of the train, the rhythmic sound of the wheels passing over the track joints, and the warmth of his sheepskin coat enabled Matt to fall asleep. A bit later on, the train ran over a rough section of track, and the movement jerked Matt awake. Although Matt had told Sheriff Craig that he was going to Denver for a piece of apple pie, the truth was he had no particular reason for going to Denver. But then he had no particular reason for being anywhere. He had no plans beyond spending a few weeks in the city enjoying the restaurants, hotels, and gaming houses. And why not? He was young and he had no familial encumbrances or obligations. The train started up the long incline that would take it to the pass at the top of Thunder Pass, and as it did so, it slowed noticeably. Matt had taken this same train trip before, and he knew that it would get much slower before finally cresting the peak. Getting up from his seat and stretching, Matt walked to the rear of the car where he stood for a moment in the warmth of the little coal stove. After that, he stepped over to the wooden water scuttle, pulled a flat paper cup from a dispenser, opened it up, and drew himself a cup of water, wishing that it was whiskey, or at least beer. 2 miles ahead of the train, Strayhorn and the others waited alongside the track.
Ah, damn, it's cold.
I'll bet old Boone ain't cold right now. Yes, sir, I'll bet old Satan has the fires turned up just real hot for him.
That ain't none funny at all. Me and Taylor's almost hung too, you know. Could have been us down there burning instead up here freezing.
Yeah, well, right now I don't know which is the worst. Freezing up here or burning down in hell.
Hey, look at this.
What is it? Look at what?
I just took me a piss on a railroad track and now it's smoking. I bet there ain't none of you ever pissed smoke before.
I swear, Loomis, you may be about the dumbest sumbitch I ever met. Your pee ain't smoking, it's steaming. See, when you take a pee on a day as cold as this, why, your pee starts to boiling as soon as it comes out.
Oh, so you mean if I peed on my hand when it's cold, it would burn?
Yeah.
You're both as dumb as shit. Here comes the train, so hush up, the lot of you. Mills, you sure you know what to do?
Yeah, I know what to do. When the train reaches the top of the grade, it'll be coming slow enough for me to climb up into the engine cabin. I'll make them stop so folks can get into the express car. Then we all ride away rich.
You're sure they're carrying $25,000?
That's what it said in a newspaper story I read.
I sure hope so. We've been out here in the cold this whole night. I just want to be sure it's worth it, that's all.
You can ride away now and get warm if you wanna.
No, I was just wondering, that's all. Hey, Strayhorn, how about if Taylor and me goes through the cars and takes whatever money the passengers is carrying on them?
We're here to get $25,000, and you're worrying about a few measly dollars the passengers might have?
We got over $150 for that stagecoach we robbed. There's a lot more people on a train than there is on a coach.
Yeah, you may be right. But I want you and Taylor out here with me. Cale, you go with Loomis. Go through every car. Don't bother none with watches or jewelry and such. Just take whatever money they got.
All right.
Loomis, you start at the back of the train. I'll start up front.
Right.
Mills, you ready?
I'm ready.
Get down there, then. It'll be slow enough when it reaches that point. You can climb on real easy. By the time it gets here, you'll have the engine stopped. You know how to do it, right?
Yeah, I just point my gun at the sons of bitches who are driving the train and tell them stop.
And what if one of the passengers comes out to see why they've stopped and starts putting up a fight?
It's Cale and Loomis's job to see they don't. Cale, Loomis, you hear that? You see any passengers who looks like he's going to get off the train, shoot him.
Cale and Loomis nodded. Seeing that Mills hadn't left yet, Strayhorn waved his hand.
Go on, get going.
Mills nodded, then hurried down to the spot by the track that Strayhorn had pointed out to him. The train approached, puffing loudly as the throttle was full open, working hard to make the long climb. At this point, the train was moving no faster than slow walk. Mills trotted alongside it, overtaking it until he drew even with the engine. Then, reaching up to grab the boarding ladder, he stepped easily onto the bottom rung. Back in the second passenger car of the train, Matt returned to his seat. His walk to the back of the car had been less to get warm and to get water than it had been to stretch and get the kinks and soreness out. Looking around at the others and noticing their pained attempts to get comfortable, he couldn't help but wonder about them. Then, with a quick intake of surprise, he noticed that one of the other people in the train was staring back at him. She was a young and very pretty woman.
I've been watching you.
Beg your pardon?
I've been watching you. You were obviously having a dream, but the dream wasn't a pleasant one.
Well, how do you know it wasn't a pleasant dream?
Because your face is remarkably reflective.
I suppose I was dreaming.
Well, dreams, like thoughts, are quite private, so I shall make no inquiries as to what it was. My name is Lane. Lane McKenzie.
I'm Matt Jensen. I'm pleased to meet you. Miss or Mrs. McKenzie?
Definitely Miss. Will you be getting off in Denver, Mr. Jensen?
With any luck. Yes. And you?
I will as well. I've come to spend some time with my uncle. It's my first time out west. Have you been to Denver before?
Yes.
How is it? The city, I mean.
But hasn't your uncle told you about it?
Oh, he says Denver is wonderful. But then, he's so sold on the West in general, and Colorado and Denver in particular, that I don't know how much credence to give his reports.
I would listen to your uncle. Denver is very nice. I've no doubt that your stay will be most pleasant.
I certainly hope so. I don't mind telling you that I'm a little apprehensive about it.
Don't be. I'm sure you'll have a fine time.
Listen to me, prattling on so to a perfect stranger. Why, my mother would be just mortified if she could see me now.
No reason she should be. We've introduced ourselves. That means we're no longer strangers.
That's right, isn't it? I mean, since we know each other's names, we aren't strangers at all.
Not at all.
Mr. Jensen, I know this is very forward of me, and I wouldn't want you to get the wrong impression, but I certainly hope we find the opportunity to meet again while we are both visiting in Denver. Do you think we will?
I don't know. Denver's a very big town.
But if the opportunity arose for us to meet again, would you welcome it?
Well, now, who wouldn't welcome the opportunity to meet such a pretty young woman?
Then she pulled the card from her handbag and handed it to Matt.
This is my carte de visite. I have written my uncle's address on the back. I do hope you will call on me while you're in town.
Thank you.
Suddenly, the train came to a stop, and a man appeared at the front of the car. He was holding a gun, and he pointed it down the car toward the passengers.
All right, folks, this here's a holdup. And if any of you men is carrying a gun, I'd advise you to take it out and put it on the floor right now.
Besides Matt, there were four other men in the car, and all four complied with the robber's request, laying their pistols on the floor. Matt stood up, the gun on his belt in plain sight.
Mister, did you hear what I said?
Yeah, I heard what you said. Now I'm telling you to drop your gun.
Oh, the hell you say, I'm just gonna kill you and be done with it.
Even before the smoke from the discharge rolled away, Matt was bailing out of the back end of the car. Hitting the ground, he dropped to his stomach, then rolled down the berm that elevated the track. At the bottom of the berm, he got up and, moving in a crouch, started toward the front of the train, where he saw several men gathered around the express car. The fireman and the engineer were both outside, standing alongside the engine with their hands in the air. One of the train robbers stepped up to the express car and banged on the side of it with the butt of his pistol.
Open the door!
I ain't gonna do it!
I ain't gonna fool around with you, mister! Open the door right now or I'm gonna start killing people! Malone, kill the engineer! We just killed the engineer! If you don't open that door in 5 seconds, I'll kill the fireman too!
Hold it!
Matt brought his pistol up and pointed it at Malone. Seeing the unexpected appearance of a passenger, Malone turned his gun away from the fireman. Realizing that they were under fire, the other robbers scattered, looking for cover. Matt saw what had to be one of the robbers coming toward him from the rear of the train. Matt returned fire, but just as he pulled the trigger, the robber leaped behind a rock. Behind Matt, the fireman had taken advantage of the situation to climb back up into the engine cab. As soon as he got there, he moved the throttle into the full position, and the train lurched forward.
Strayhorn, the train's getting away!
Mills, stop it!
Mills jumped up onto the mountain ladder and climbed up to the cab. Just as he got there, though, the fireman smashed Mills in the head with the shovel. At the same time the fireman hit Mills, Mills pulled the trigger. Mills fell from the mountain ladder, and he was ground up by the wheels of the tender car when the train passed over him.
Strayhorn, the train is still going!
Hennessy? Hennessy, is that you?
Son of a bitch, Strayhorn! It's Jensen! Jensen's on the train! Get the horses! Let's get out of here!
Upon hearing Strayhorn order the others to get mounted, the robber who had been engaging Matt stood up.
No, you don't, Strayhorn! You fellas ain't leaving me behind!
We ain't coming back for you, Cale! You gotta run forward like the rest of us!
Drop your gun, Cale!
The hell you say?
Behind him, Matt knew that the remaining outlaws were getting away. He looked in the direction of the sound, hoping to be able to get a shot, but the riders had already disappeared into the darkness of the night, leaving behind four bodies, two killed by Matt, one killed when he fell under the train, and the engineer was killed by the outlaws. In addition, there was one more dead outlaw on the train, killed in Matt's very first confrontation with them. The attempted train robbery was a bloody failure, due primarily to the fact that Matt had been a passenger on the train. The train! Matt suddenly realized that the train was underway and already picking up a good deal of momentum.
Whoa, hold it!
Facing the possibility of being left out here alone, Matt broke into a run to catch up to it. He barely grabbed the boarding ladder at the very end of the train, then pulled himself up onto the rear vestibule. As the speed of the train increased even more, the cars began jerking back and forth, throwing the passengers from side to side. The conductor came into the car then, and he was barely able to stand, negotiating the center aisle only by holding onto the backs of the seats. The expression on the conductor's face was one of fear.
Conductor, what's going on? The danger's over now. Why are we going so fast?
God help me, I don't know. After we clear Thunder Pass, we're supposed to go down the hill not much faster than we went up it, but we're going over 60 miles per hour. If we don't slow down before we get to Miller's Curve, we'll go off the track.
Well, that will certainly slow us down.
No, you don't understand. There's a 50-foot high trestle at Miller's Curve. If we go off the track, we'll tumble down into a gulch. The engineer should know this.
Shit. The engineer isn't driving this train.
How do you know the engineer isn't driving the train?
Because I saw the robbers kill the engineer.
Oh, my God. George's wife just had a new baby.
The engineer isn't driving, then who is?
Well, it has to be the fireman. He can operate the engine as well as the engineer.
If he should drive the train as well as the engineer, he should know better than to go this fast, shouldn't he?
Yes, he certainly should know. I have no idea why he's running the train this fast.
Could be that he isn't. The robbers may have killed the fireman as well. I did see someone fire into the engine cab just before he fell from the train.
That doesn't make sense. If both of them were dead, the train wouldn't even be moving.
Unless the fireman got the train started before they killed him.
Oh, good Lord in heaven. Do you mean to tell me there's nobody driving this train?
I'm beginning to think that's very possible. Otherwise, we wouldn't be running downhill with the throttle full open.
So what do we do now?
All we have to do is get to the engine and stop it.
The problem is there's no way to get to the engine.
Why not? Seems to me like all you've had to do is go through all the cars until you get to the tender. Climb over it and you're in the engine.
Not possible. There are two express cars between the passenger cars and the engine, and you can't get through them. The only way you're going to get to the engine is if you climb over the top of those two cars.
Is there a brakeman on board? Someone's used to doing that sort of thing?
No need for brakeman on this train, mister. This is a passenger train. We're equipped with Westinghouse air brakes.
The train seemed to increase speed, and the back and forth whipping motion of the car became even more extreme.
Damn!
Matt started toward the front of the car.
Where are you going? What are you doing?
I'm going to go through this train and get to the engine.
You're crazy. You'll never make it.
Doesn't look like I have much of a choice, does it? I either die trying to stop this train, or I die when it goes off the trestle and crashes into the gorge. So I'm gonna try. Now the question is, once I get there, how do I stop it?
It's impossible.
Stop telling me what's impossible and tell me something that can help me. Now once I get into the engine, how do I stop this damn train?
There'll be a big lever running horizontally across the cab from left to the right. That's the throttle. Pull it all the way back. Also, there's a Johnson bar, which is a sturdy-looking ratcheted lever with a hand release. This is a vertical bar on the right. And right next to it, you'll see a chunky-looking brass handle sticking out to the left. That's the air brakes.
What do I do with the Johnson bar?
You don't have to do anything with it. I was just pointing it out to you to help you find the air brakes is all. The Johnson bar controls the direction the steam takes in going into the cylinders. That's what makes the train run forward or in reverse. But when you close the throttle, no steam will be going into the cylinders anyway.
Matt started to open the door, then paused long enough to take off his coat.
You better keep that coat on, mister. It's not more than 10 degrees outside, and with the wind blowing on you at 60 miles per hour, you're likely to freeze to death before you get there.
I think I'll feel more secure up there if I'm not bound up by the coat.
When Matt reached the second car, Lane was shocked when she saw him.
Oh, thank God you're alive. We thought you had been killed. What's happening? Why are we going so fast?
I'm not sure, but I intend to find out.
Matt passed through four more cars before reaching the first of the two express cars he was going to have to negotiate. When he reached the vestibule platform here, he saw why he would not be able to go through the express cars. Unlike the passenger cars, the express car had no end doors. He was going to have to climb up to the top. Matt grabbed a ladder rung, then jerked his hand back. The metal rung was so cold that it had almost the same effect as if he had grabbed a piece of hot iron from a blacksmith's forge. Matt steeled himself, then grabbed it again, this time forcing himself to hold on. He put his foot on the bottom rung, then climbed to the top of the car. Just as he reached the top, though, his foot slipped off the icy rung, causing him to fall. He managed to grab the top rung, though his face hit the corner of the car, cutting a deep gash in his cheek. Disregarding the bleeding wound, he held on until he was able to gain purchase with his foot. Then he propelled himself up over the edge and onto the top of the car. The sleet had taken effect on top of the car so that it was covered with a sheet of ice. Also, the train was traveling so fast that he was in a 60-mile-per-hour slipstream. In addition, the top of the car was like the end of a pendulum, so that the lateral movement was more extreme up here than it would have been down inside the cars. Matt tried to stand up, hoping he could sustain himself by bending forward against the wind, but his foot slipped on the ice. After that, he quit trying to stand and instead moved forward on his hands and knees, crawling as quickly as he could. When he reached the front end of the car, he realized that, under these conditions, he would not be able to bridge the gap between them without climbing down this car and then up on the next. Taking pains to be more careful this time, Matt climbed down, stepped across the connecting plates, and climbed up the other side. As he raised his head above the top of the car, though, he saw that they were approaching a tunnel. He ducked back down as the train entered the tunnel, then hung on for dear life as the noise of the train roared back at him from the tunnel walls. Finally, the train emerged from the tunnel and crawled across the roof of this car as he had the previous one. The tender was a little easier to navigate because he was down inside rather than on top. That way, he didn't feel as if he were about to be thrown off. Then, climbing down the front of the tender, he stepped across the footplate until he was inside the engine. The cab was lit by a storm lantern, which put out just enough light to be able to see the valves, levers, handles, protuberances, coils, chains, and gauges that made up the mysterious workings and mechanical contrivances of the engine. The light also showed what had happened to the fireman. He was lying on the floor with a black hole in his forehead. As Matt wiped some of the blood away from his own cheek, he studied the back of the huge round boiler. There was a large gauge on top with a needle that was quivering just inside a red wedge on the face of it. Attachments, hoses, coils, faucet handles, cylinders, canisters that looked like coffee pots and deep fry cookers protruded, extended, sat upon, and hung from every part of the boiler. Then he saw the long horizontal bar that the conductor had told him would be the throttle. It was in a full forward position. He pulled it all the way back, while at the same time, he pulled the brass handle back that the conductor had identified as the brake handle. Matt's actions had an immediate consequence as he felt the driver wheels lock into place, allowing the train to slide along the rails. But the rails were coated with ice, and even though the heavy train and the friction of sliding steel wheels on steel rails generated enough heat to cut through the ice, Matt realized that it wasn't braking effectively enough. Matt looked down at the Johnson bar, remembering that the conductor told him that its only purpose was to make the train go in reverse. Getting an idea, Matt pulled the Johnson bar all the way back, then he pushed the throttle all the way forward. Once more, the cylinders and actuating rods began operating, but this time in the opposite direction. The huge driver wheel started a backward rotation, and Matt was rewarded by seeing a tremendous shower of sparks flying out from either side of the engine, generated by the wheels spinning in reverse. Gradually, the train began to slow down, but as he looked ahead in the beam of light thrown out by the gas headlamp, he saw that the track ahead was making a sharp curve to the left and onto a trestle. The light also picked up a sign along the edge of the track.
Engineers, proceed slowly. Oh, fuck me, I'm trying to!
The sign slid by, still at considerable speed. The braking became more and more pronounced until, finally, just as it was entering the curve, the train came to a stop. Matt closed the throttle and put the Johnson bar in the middle. He stood there in the engine cab for a long moment.
You did it! You did it! By damn, you did it!
Turning, Matt saw that the conductor had climbed the boarding ladder and was stepping into the engine cabin with him.
Yeah, I did it. But now what?
What do you mean, now what?
Are we going to get this train into the station?
Well, not to worry. There's an engineer and fireman deadheading back to Denver. They'll take us in.
Yeah? Where were they a few minutes ago when I needed them?